It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's start off today by going back to 2008. Few thought a freshman U.S. Senator from Illinois named Barack Obama would be able to win the Democratic nomination. He did, of course. And the Iowa caucuses in January of 2008 were the first proving grounds in pursuit of that nomination. Here's Obama speaking right after winning the Iowa caucuses. This is at Hy-Vee Hall in Des Moines.
Thank you, Iowa. You know, they said this day would never come. They said our sights were set too high. They said this country was too divided, too disillusioned to ever come together around a common purpose. But on this January night, at this defining moment in history, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do.
Well, my guest this hour took the title of his book from that victory speech. Chris Liddell Westerfeld is the author of They Said This Day Would Never Come, Chasing the Dream on Obama's Improbable Campaign. It was about a year and a half before that momentous caucus win in the summer of 2007 that Chris joined the Obama for America campaign. However, Obama had captured Chris's imagination several years earlier. His book draws not only from his experiences going back, way back to 2004 when Barack Obama was first elected U.S. Senator from Illinois, but also from more than 200 interviews he conducted more recently with alumni of that presidential campaign, including David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, and Barack Obama himself. Now, after being part of Obama's successful bid, Chris went on to spend 5 years on the Obama White House staff, ending up as the former assistant staff secretary at the Obama White House. He is an Iowa City native. He currently works as an oral historian in Washington, D.C., and joins me today in the studio. Chris, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a fascinating book, and you put a lot of work into it, interviewing and getting so many perspectives on that campaign, a campaign which is, it's hard to believe, more than 10 years in the past. Does it seem like 10 years in the past to you?
No, not at all.
Let's travel back to 2007, or even earlier than that. I'd like you to read sort of the introductory narrative of your reflections. As I mentioned, Barack Obama, this figure little known at that time outside of Illinois, and sort of your introduction to getting to know him, or how he captured your imagination. Would you read from the very first page of your book called Swept Up, right?
Yeah. In my sophomore year of college, my roommate Sean ordered us matching dark blue Barack Obama for Senate t-shirts. Sean and I were students at the University of Iowa, and because Iowa was a swing state with presidential candidates visiting all the time, it felt like we were at the center of the political world. It was fall 2004, 18 months after George W. Bush invaded Iraq, and the stakes of that year's presidential campaign felt life or death. President Bush launching a preemptive war in Iraq when I was 17 is what made me care about politics. As I realized that President Bush's election had led to people my age being sent to war, I started to follow campaigns in the same obsessive way I tracked baseball box scores as a kid. This was before Twitter, so Sean and I would spend hours refreshing realclearpolitics.com trying to dissect the latest polls, most of which we did not understand, and speculating about what soon-to-be President John Kerry's Democratic Senate majority could accomplish. Though we watched dozens of races across the country that fall, I didn't care for most politicians. Obama, who was running for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, was the only one we deemed T-shirt worthy. Everything about him felt different. His Democratic National Convention speech included aspirational language that sounded revolutionary compared to his peers. Obama had spent his 20s as a community organizer, written a memoir that examined his biracial identity and detailed youthful drug use, and been elected the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. He was young, he was smart, he seemed honest, and unlike nearly every other prominent Democrat, he had been right about the most important policy question in my lifetime. He had opposed the Iraq War before it began. He was also on the verge of becoming only the third black person elected to the U.S. Senate since Reconstruction.
Chris, Liddell Westerveld reading from his book, They Said This Day Would Never Come, Chasing the Dream on Obama's Improbable Campaign. So, Chris, that's how it started for you. What happened after then? You're at the University of Iowa. The neighboring state has a U.S. senator that captures your imagination. How many felt like you did, you and your roommate? And what else could you tell about what was gathering around Barack Obama in terms of enthusiasm?
Well, I think it's easy to forget just how despondent people were after the 2004 election. George W. Bush was reelected with a majority of the vote. He won Iowa by less than 5 votes per precinct in the general election that year. And there was a sense among a lot of people that they just didn't know what to do. And I was one of them. I was only 19, but this was something that I just felt really confused by. I couldn't believe that the country had gone in this direction. And so out of that environment, Obama became this young rising star in the U.S. Senate. But many people did not expect him to run for president right away in 2008. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I did when I was not sure what to do in the aftermath of the 2004 election was read as much as I could about past presidential elections. And something I discovered that many Iowans know is if you want to get involved in a presidential election, there's few better places to be than Iowa. And
right.
Within Iowa, there are few better places to be than Iowa City if you're a Democrat, because this is the most liberal county in the state that matters most for the presidential nominating process. And so over the course of college, I started to realize all these people who want to run for president are going to visit my town and just be available for people to meet them as they think about running. And so I would go to all these small events as a college student, and things would happen. Like John Kerry showed up for a tailgate in 2006, and walking down Olive Court, there's a very famous photo that went out on the AP of someone handing him a beer bong and him politely declining it as he continues to make his way to a tailgate.
And this is in Iowa City.
This is in Iowa City. Another thing that happened that year is Mark Warner, the governor of Virginia, showed up at the Iowa City Fieldhouse and just played basketball with a dozen college students. And I remember doing that and thinking, like, I keep waiting for some photographer to show up and document that he's doing this. But someone told me in reality he just likes basketball. And so you have all these opportunities to see these people before they become who they become, before they're known nationally. And so I would try to take advantage of that as much as I could as a college student. But the person that I kept hoping would run was the person who never showed up, Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And so I assumed he wouldn't run for president in 2008. And that didn't change until fall of my senior year when he showed up for the Harkin steak fry.
Right. If we remember, we go back that time there, it was thought, well, politically, it was not wise to not complete a Senate term and then run for the presidency before your first Senate term, right? That was the thinking at that time.
That's right. He would be asked about this. He was asked about this at his first press conference as a senator-elect. Will you run for president in 2008? He said categorically no. And you know what he has said is his thinking started to change in fall 2006, traveling around the country, seeing the response he was getting around the time of the publication of his book, Audacity of Hope. And one of the places where he saw that response happen was here in Iowa, where when he went to the Harkin Steak Fry, which was this political fundraiser, in the first place I saw him speak in person, and many Iowans did.
Okay, take us back to this. This is September 2006,
yeah.
Right? The Harkin Steak Fry, a big deal. Former U.S. Senator Tom Harkin had an annual steak fry, which represented what? What was this gathering about?
So technically, this gathering is an annual political fundraiser. And so Tom Harkin, who was the U.S. Senator from Iowa for 30 years and a member of the U.S. House for 10 years before that, had this longstanding tradition that went back to the 70s where he would host a steak fry where they would actually grill steak. And you would pay $10, $20, some years it was higher, for a ticket. And it essentially served as a fundraiser for the Iowa Democratic Party and for his reelection campaign. But he would always try to get a high-profile speaker as part of that. And one of the first stories in the book is the story of Obama deciding to go to the Harkin Steak Fry.
And he had to be convinced to do that.
That's right. He had to be convinced to do that. And so it was fall 2006. The 2008 campaign was looming on the horizon, and apparently Senator Harkin didn't want to invite any of his Senate colleagues who might be running for president so he wouldn't be accused of currying favor with one of them or giving someone an undue advantage. And so because Obama had said forever he wasn't going to run, Harkin really pressed him hard. You know, you should really do this. It'd be great for the party. It would really help us out in Iowa if you came and do this. So eventually Obama relents. So what struck me about that event was traditionally about less than 1,000 people go to this. And that year it was in the Warren County Fairgrounds. And when you walked in, you were struck by how many young people were there. And they weren't there because they loved Tom Harkin, as great as Tom Harkin is. They were there because they were interested in Barack Obama. So for an event that usually had less than 1,000 people show up, this had about 3,000 people show up. And you would see people there from Grinnell, from Drake, from Iowa, high school students even showing up. And the other thing that struck me about going to that event is whenever I would go to these local political events, I would see politicians essentially pitch Iowans on why they should run for president. You know, there was one senator who came in 2006, and he literally put up a map of all the counties of his state and put in red and blue which counties he had won and which counties John Kerry had lost. And that was his case for why he should run for president.
A very pragmatic but less than inspirational case.
Correct. And so again and again, you would if you went to these events, you would see politicians essentially pitching Iowans on, here's why I should run for president, mm-hmm. and you should like me. And what struck me about that event that Obama did at the Steak Fry was he did this rope line afterwards. And again, people would come up to him and say, I really hope we see you next year. I hope you run for president in 2008.
Really?
I would really get behind you if you ran.
Well, the expectations were high. People had obviously heard about this U.S. Senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. What was the effect that he had on that crowd at the Harkin Steak Fry in 2006 that you could remember? What was his speech about? He went, to the heart, not to the head?
Yeah, I think there was that. I had to go back and watch the speech again because I couldn't remember anything he said. I mean, it wasn't so much what he said. It was the way he said it, the way he drew the crowd out, the way he connected with people. And that sounds very ephemeral. That sounds very shallow. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about politics, that's very real. I mean, that really matters to people, the way someone makes them feel. He was just so radically different from what you heard coming out of the White House at that point, the Bush White House, and the way you heard other Democrats talking about politics at that point. It was very much a progressive politics that did not lead with division at a time where so much of politics that especially was coming out of the White House, was coming out of the Republican Party who was in power, was about dividing Americans, whether it was over the prosecution of the war in Iraq, whether it was over marriage equality, all these different ways that you were made to feel like you don't belong here if you don't agree with the present administration. And Obama was the exact opposite of that.
My guest this hour, if you just joined us, Chris Liddell Westerfeld, author of They Said This Day Would Never Come, Chasing the Dream on Obama's Improbable Campaign. Not only Chris's experiences in this book, but a good deal of quotes from the more than 200 interviews he conducted with members of that campaign team, David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, others, and of course Obama himself. Let's move past the Harkin Steak Fry to sort of the next chapter, the marker in your book, up to by January 2007. Then U.S. Senator Barack Obama had announced an exploratory committee. So he'd come out and realized that something was moving here, that he was then going to consider a presidential run, or had said, when you announce an exploratory committee, you're more or less saying, I'm game.
Right.
Right.
And so by January 2007, Obama had announced this exploratory committee. And I, like thousands of other people, logged onto his website and tried to donate money to it. And I filled out this form asking to volunteer. And what often happens when you have a campaign with a lot of people who are interested in volunteering but no infrastructure because you haven't thought that long about running is no one gets back to you when you offer to volunteer. So
they couldn't handle it.
Right. They couldn't handle the demand. And so because I was in Iowa, I just started emailing everyone I knew, everyone I had come into contact with, and said, I want to be involved in this campaign. When it happens, can you find me a way? Can you find a way for me to get involved?
Specifically the Obama campaign.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And we have to remember at this time, we're a year away from the Iowa caucuses, which Obama would win. But the big heavy hitters here, of course, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Bill Richardson of New Mexico, Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, other names as well. So Barack Obama definitely on the fringe.
Right. So I think people talk about Obama as this great orator, great politician. But at the time when he announced for president, he was running second nationally, a distant second to Hillary Clinton, who people widely assumed would be the nominee. And then here in Iowa, he was running third to John Edwards and Hillary Clinton. Edwards had been Kerry's running mate in 2004. He had finished second in the 2004 caucus. And so here in Iowa, it was a really uphill battle. But his core strategy was essentially to do well in Iowa and let the momentum from Iowa carry over to the other early states.
Mm-hmm.
So when he set up his campaign, when I talked to members of the campaign leadership for the book, what they talk about is every decision that had to be made was made through the prism of how does this help us win Iowa? Because if it doesn't help us win Iowa, then we don't do it. Mm-hmm. And so that entire year throughout 2007 leading up to January 2008, we think of these primaries as national competitions, and obviously they are, but they're also sequential. And so much of that year was about doing well in Iowa, whether that was directing resources there, directing staff there, directing Obama's time there, which is why the period in Iowa takes up such a big part of this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to jump forward because of our time. We've only got an hour, unfortunately. Let's go up to the point you were offered a paid position as a field organizer in the summer of 2007. So then it really gets going. This is hitting high gear then, right?
That's right, yeah. So in 2007, I helped start the Obama student group here at the University of Iowa and then was spending all my time volunteering. And then after I graduated, was offered a job as an organizer here in Johnson County. And so organizers are essentially the people who knock on your door and call you on the phone. They're the people closest to the ground on a campaign staff. And Obama's strategy in Iowa was essentially to embed more than 100 organizers in counties across the state. And so I was one of about 100 people at that time working in different counties.
I'd like to ask you to read another passage from your book, Chris. This is a part that sort of explains the difference between you and many of the other organizers. We're raised here in Iowa. We're very familiar with the Iowa caucuses, our political environment. Not so of many of the other organizers, right?
That's right, yeah. And so, you know, I was introduced to the caucus at an early age when my dad was a precinct captain for someone running for president. And so one of the things I found interviewing people for this book is how many had come to Iowa knowing nearly nothing about what they were signing up for. And so this section talks a little bit about that. Like many of the new people arriving in Iowa, I didn't have a great sense of what my new job would look like day to day. But I was one of the few who came into the role already familiar with Iowa's caucus process. The most important thing to understand about the Iowa caucuses was that they're not a statewide election. There are 1,781 simultaneous neighborhood meetings attended by no more than 10% of the total population. That process influenced how you organized. To get to know a community, you would start by trying to meet community leaders, because those are the people their neighbors would look to on caucus night. The rules of a caucus allow one voice to change a room. If you can convince your neighbors to back your candidate, no matter what the results are statewide, you can win your neighborhood. This was the biggest difference between me and the out-of-state newcomers. I didn't know how to organize, but I knew the community where I was stationed. Our campaign office was across the street from the community rec center where I learned to swim, one block east of the library where I learned to read, and around the corner from the hookah bar where I had celebrated my 21st birthday. Aside from being at work most of the day, my life continued as it had before. I was aware that most of the other kids working for Obama had left behind relationships, jobs, or school for the chance to move to a state they had never visited and work in a new community for a candidate they knew very little about. It took a unique personality to make that leap.
Chris Liddell Westerveld reading from They Said This Day Would Never Come. So, Chris, at this time, you are in a paid position, field organizer for the Obama campaign. What happens next? In your book, you point out the Jefferson-Jackson dinner in November of 2007 as a real point to focus on. This is an annual celebration of the Democratic Party. It's been renamed now. It's called the Liberty and Justice Fundraiser. Describe what happened at that dinner.
Yeah, so the Jefferson-Jackson dinner was in November 2007, about 2 months before the Iowa caucus that year. And it was this real turning point that a lot hinged on. It was one of the first times that Obama's supporters, who had all been working separately in their own counties, came together and saw each other in person. And in addition to that, every candidate would appear on stage there at the Jefferson-Jackson dinner and give a speech without notes, without a teleprompter, without a podium for 10 minutes. And so it becomes this almost professional wrestling match style political event. It walking into it, it felt like the most high-stakes pep rally of all time. It's a 9,000-person arena. You've got this stage in the round in the middle of the arena surrounded by tables and then everyone else up in the bleachers. Going into that night, Obama was still not leading in Iowa. He was still losing, and his entire strategy depended on Iowa. And so there was a lot riding on his performance that night, but not just his performance, the performance of all of his supporters. There was a huge rally they did prior to the event where 3,000 Obama supporters gathered at a neighboring arena and marched down the street together to the Jefferson-Jackson dinner. This major show of force that shows everyone, these are all the supporters we have. And each one of them carried a lighted stick displaying the name of the county they were from. So all 99 counties were represented. And you would talk to people afterwards. It was a great speech Obama gave. But still, even after that, some of his opponents weren't taking him seriously. There was this great quote by Hillary Clinton's chief strategist saying, our supporters look like caucus goers, his look like Facebook. And so there's still, even 2 months out after that great speech, there's a lot of trepidation about, can he pull this off? Can he put together an organization?
But that was a turning point in what way? November 2007, that Jefferson-Jackson dinner.
It was a turning point in that he gave the best speech of his campaign. And everyone in that arena and everyone covering the event saw both how good he was as a speaker and how strong his organization was in the state. And those two things combined rippled out over the course of the next 2 months.
We'll be back in just a moment with more from my guest this hour, Chris Liddell Westerfeld. They said this day would never come, the title of his book. He joined the Obama for America campaign in 2007 and eventually spent 5 years in the Obama White House on staff. And we'll be back with more of his reflections in his new book about that momentous campaign, which led to the election of Barack Obama. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, Chris Liddell Westerfeld. He's the author of They Said This Day Would Never Come, Chasing the Dream on Obama's Improbable Campaign. A fascinating book and the fascinating conversation, because Chris was joined the Obama for America campaign way back in 2007. He was a field organizer. He spent then, after the campaign, 5 years in the Obama White House staff, and we're having him walk us through the campaign, an insider's view. And as part of this book, he interviewed more than 200 people, alumni of the campaign. And we'll hopefully have some reflections on that. Chris, let's get back to it. When we left off, you talked about what a turning point the Jefferson-Jackson dinner had been in November of 2007. We're just a couple months away from the Iowa caucuses in January of 2008, which, of course, Obama had a surprise victory in. Talk about how polling and fundraising changed over those months, because as you mentioned, he was polling behind John Edwards, behind Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah, and so if you look over the course of that year in 2007, it was only in the final weeks leading up to the Iowa caucus that he finally was listed first in any Iowa polls, and it still wasn't true that he was leading every poll up until caucus day. You know, there were still two that came out in the final week that showed Clinton leading. And so that's one of the reasons why the victory that night was such a shock to so many people, because it wasn't seen as a sure thing at any point. And I think one of the things that is unique about the Iowa caucus is the importance of organization. You know, the caucus is not an election. It's a neighborhood meeting. You have to go out. You have to spend multiple hours there. And so so much of the work that was done by the Iowa team in the year leading up to the caucus, which is done by any campaign in Iowa, is finding precinct captains, people who can lead you, lead your forces on caucus night in their neighborhood, mm-hmm. people who will organize for you in the weeks leading up to the caucus. And what you started to see shifting in the polling is as the campaign gets more and more supporters over time, you know, his numbers creep up more and more. But the other thing that's happening that's not reflected so much in the polling is the number of supporters that they're getting, people who sign commit cards saying, I will show up at the caucus for you, is growing day by day through this organization that's being built. And so these 100-plus organizers across the state of Iowa, they essentially had two jobs. One was to build a list of supporters, and two was to build relationships with those supporters so they would actually turn out on caucus night. Mm-hmm. And so everything that you would do on the campaign would flow into one of those two buckets. And so there would be people like Nancy Bobo, who was a precinct captain in Des Moines. She was an example of someone who would spend time every week going down to the Obama office, making phone calls, helping the organizers there, canvassing her own neighborhood. And the work of those people is the core work that leads up to the caucus.
And Chris, you are an oral historian. You've done these many interviews, recorded them. Let's hear a little bit of the woman you mentioned, a volunteer from Des Moines, Nancy Bobo, reflecting on the campaign.
Oh, I love the staff here. These were the hardest working group of young people. And we would, you know, I was down there almost every night after work. And they always, the one thing that they always did, they were the most appreciative people on earth for anything you did for them. And that appreciation went a long way. They didn't just, you know, oh, well, she's here again. You know, they were down there working 16 hours a day. And these young people are sitting down there in this crappy office that just has very few redeeming qualities. You know, they're sitting at these old desks that are rattly and falling apart, and they've got paper everywhere. And it just looks like a disaster, like a tornado has swept through there. And you look around the room and you think, this is how presidents are elected. You know, it's in this chaos. This is how presidents are elected. It's not a neat, orderly process. It's a mess.
Okay, Nancy Bobo, it's a mess, but also she goes on in your book to talk about how this is what probably the biggest thing she'll ever do in her life.
That's right, yeah. I think so much when you think about politics, the way it's depicted on TV is so many people associate it with the West Wing, this experience where you're advising a candidate or you're spending time with a bunch of other people that are your age working on something together. And there is some of that. But the experience for so many people I would interview with this book was the experience of moving to a place where they didn't know anyone, to do a job they barely understood for a candidate who was likely to lose for either no money or very little money. And so what happens when you do that is the only way to survive that experience is to build a community, to get to know the people who live there. And so there's one organizer I remember who talked about thinking, well, I'm going to be stationed in Des Moines. She had come from Maryland. This was her first real political job, and she was told, you are going to go out to Charles City, and that's where you're going to work. And so she talks about having this vision of making all these friends working together in the same office and then driving out to Charles City, which is about 8,000-person town, about 45 minutes away from Mason City, and there's just cornfields surrounding the town. And she didn't know a soul when she showed up. Mm-hmm. She just had a list of voters. And eventually she had to start calling people, and she had to start knocking on doors, and she had to start finding people. And what happened for her was an 84-year-old man, a retiree, became her closest friend in the town. And he would take her to the local church. He would have lunch with her once a week, and she would walk him back to his house because the town was so small. And he would introduce her to other people. And then those people would introduce her to other people. And so this act of building community is something that takes place over the course of the year leading up to the Iowa caucus. And so interviewing people like Nancy, people who had volunteered either in Des Moines or somewhere else as precinct captains, they would become really emotional talking about the relationships they developed over the course of that year.
And that's something you bring out in this book, the emotion as a, what is it, often overlooked as the driver of this campaign.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, one of the first questions that you were asked when you became a field organizer was, why are you here? Not why do you support Barack Obama? Not why do you think Barack Obama should be president? But why are you here? What compels you to do this work, to devote yourself to this? And finding that internal reason about why it was important was something you had to do, because inevitably the candidate's going to screw up. You're going to screw up. The campaign's going to let you down. And so in those situations where you're the only person surrounding you doing this, to get through them when the days are really hard, to doing something that's really unlikely, you have to understand this is why I'm here. This is what I'm here for. This is what I'm hoping to accomplish out of this.
Mm-hmm. Chris, the time is quickly getting away from us. Let's zoom to caucus night, 2008, that surprise victory. I remember observing this at an elementary school in Iowa City, where I was so surprised by the enthusiasm of the Obama campaign organizers there. The Clinton campaign, remember, we were assuming Hillary Clinton was going to win this. By the time I left that precinct and observing that caucus, the Clinton campaign people looked so deflated. And I have to believe this happened in precincts all around the state. What was your experience on caucus night?
Well, on caucus night, I pulled up to my a different Iowa City elementary school to caucus with my family. And as an organizer, I was responsible for 17 precincts. And so one of the ways things are different now is back then I had a flip phone. And the first day that the campaign paid for you to get text messages was caucus day. So in the year leading up to the caucus, you had no way to communicate via text. And so I remember holding my flip phone in the school, texting with precinct captains, trying to get information on what's going on, what's going on, what's going on. And then at one point, there was a text that came through that said, "The Associated Press predicts Barack Obama will win the Iowa caucuses." And just this feeling of relief and elation.
What was the actual reaction in the school hall that you were in?
Well, because no one had smartphones back then, almost no one else knew. I was sent a text the second it happened. And so in my caucus site, everyone was focused on the allocation in the room. And so we were still counting delegates. We were still figuring out who was going to be the delegate to the next to the county convention, and that was everyone's focus. So I remember walking over to my parents and just showing them the phone and saying, "We won." And then it taking a while for everyone else to realize what had happened.
You collected so many interviews for this book, including from Barack Obama. Let's hear a clip from him, because his reflection on the caucus night is amazing, because he puts it, what, above winning the general election or on par with it?
That's right. He does.
This is a conversation you had with Barack Obama when?
It was in February 2015. So when I left the White House in January 2014, one of the things that you do is you take an exit photo with the president. And I told him what I was doing. And he said, "Well, when you're ready, let me know and I'll do an interview with you." And so about a year later, after I'd done 200 interviews, I came back and he sat down for half an hour with me to talk about this experience and why it was important to him.
Okay. Barack Obama reflecting in 2015 about the Iowa caucus win in 2008.
Yeah, that's my favorite night of my entire political career. To me, that was a more powerful night than the night I was elected president. Yeah, we went to a school where the caucus was being held. And I remember pulling up and just seeing all these cars in the parking lot and getting out of the car and just watching folks streaming into the school. And it was cold. You know, those couple nights before the caucuses were a couple of the coldest nights of the year. And we got inside and it was just this sea of people.
Okay, Barack Obama being interviewed in the Oval Office in February of 2015 by my guest, Chris Liddell Westerfeld. If you've just joined us, he's with me this hour, author of They Said This Day Would Never Come. He's conducted more than 200 interviews with alumni of that campaign, including, obviously, Barack Obama. Let's go to the general election. Between caucus day and the general election, there is a huge battle over months for the nomination. What was your insider's view of that battle?
Well, I think, you know, leading up to the caucus day, I had no concept of what would happen next. And so the day after Obama won, there was a staff meeting, and they had a conference call and called everyone together and said, some of you are going to Nevada, some of you are going to South Carolina, and the rest of you are going out to February 5th states, which were 22 states expected to vote all on February 5th. And the assumption at that point was that that was the day the nomination would be decided. And of course, what ended up happening is Hillary Clinton won New Hampshire, Barack Obama won South Carolina, and then this battle played out over the next 3 or 4 months that involved nearly every state in the country. And I think what people forget about that time is just how heated that experience got.
Oh, yeah. A lot of, well, bad blood created.
That's right. For supporters of both candidates, each candidate would say things that would be either spur of the moment or be taken out of context, and it would just inflame their supporters' passions even more. The one advantage of that extended primary was it allowed every part of the country to play a role in this just about. And so you would go to places. I ended up working in 6 states over the course of that primary and general election. And every state was a different experience because every community was experiencing this in a different way. You know, just like in Iowa, you would bring the issues of your community to how you looked at this campaign, the history of your community. And so organizing for Barack Obama in Mobile, Alabama, where so many people have firsthand memories of the civil rights movement and have experienced it, was a totally different experience than doing it up here in Iowa. Going to coastal Mississippi, where there hasn't been a contested general election in a very long time, and the walk lists are all out of date so that you don't even use them. You just go to every door in neighborhoods that are more likely to support you, was totally different from, say, Texas.
You mentioned earlier how emotion played such a huge part in this campaign. I wonder for you, is there a completely emotional moment that caught you off guard unexpectedly, perhaps in Iowa, perhaps organizing in another state, that you will carry with you always?
Yeah, I mean, for me, so much of that campaign was about people understanding and internalizing and then taking action because they realized they had a voice in this process. And so, you know, when I was in Iowa, I was responsible for 17 precincts, and I had to find a precinct captain for each of them. And there was one precinct where I was just beating my head against the wall trying to find somebody. I couldn't find somebody. And eventually I settled on this guy, Mel, who was a African-American attorney originally from Arkansas in his late 30s. And he lived in this precinct that was small and almost entirely elderly white farmers or people connected to agriculture in some way. And the caucus is a public event. You have to go into a room and say, this is who I'm supporting, and I think you should come stand with me in supporting them. And Mel was reluctant to get on board with Obama for a long time, but eventually I got him to go to a Michelle Obama event, and he went and saw her speak in person, and that sealed the deal. He said, I'll support him, but I'm not going to volunteer. I'm not going to be a precinct captain. And eventually I kept talking to him and kept talking to him. And as we got closer to the caucus, I said, Mel, I really have no one else to do this. Like, if you don't do this, no one's going to be the precinct captain in your precinct. We're going to lose. And I think the process of him hearing that if no one else did this but him, it wasn't going to happen, something clicked and he agreed to do it. And he started calling people in his precinct, and he hated calling people. It was just he would get hung up on, and he would become so frustrated making these calls. But he kept doing it because he felt like he had a say in this process. And then on caucus night, the first call I got where I heard that we had won a precinct was from Mel. And he had walked into this precinct, and it was a one-delegate precinct, which meant he had to win the majority of the room. And he would tell me later, he's the only, aside from his wife, the only non-white person in the precinct. And so walking in, getting a majority of this room to come over to his side in a place where he was not from, that he hadn't grown up there, surrounded by all these people who had, hearing him talk about that, hearing him win, and knowing that if he had not stepped up and done that, then we would have lost that precinct. And thinking about how that played out thousands of times, both in Iowa and across the country, is something that always sticks with me from that campaign.
Lots of many, many emotional moments, undoubtedly, for you as working in the Barack Obama campaign in 2007 and 2008. Let's address election night, November 2008. What are your strongest memories from that?
Well, for election night, I was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And one of the things that's striking to me when I went to write this book was how often I had predicted things in 2008 and been wrong. So one of the things that I predicted would happen was for the general election, I was offered the chance to either go back to Iowa or go to North Carolina. And I went to North Carolina because most of my friends were there. But I remember going and thinking, well, inevitably we'll be pulled out of North Carolina and sent to a state that's more competitive because there's no chance we're going to win North Carolina. Mm. And so election night, I was in Chapel Hill and I watched the returns come in. And right after Obama won, I remember stepping outside of this restaurant and this sort of sound coming over a hill and going outside, walking up the street with a couple people who were volunteers and realizing that thousands of students had rushed to this intersection in Chapel Hill. And it was as if UNC had won the Final Four. People were screaming in this intersection. They shut down traffic. Someone played Obama's victory speech over a boombox. Someone saw the organizer who had handled the campus area, recognized him, lifted them up on their shoulders, and he crowd surfed through the intersection while people chanted, "Obama, Obama." And you saw scenes like that play out across the country that night, on election night of 2008. There's the famous scene in Grant Park where 250,000 people gathered to watch Obama's victory speech. But all these local celebrations happened as well. And so hearing how people had experienced that night was one of the more enjoyable parts of this book.
So, Chris, it's now the start of 2020. Hard to believe that you're starting the Barack Obama campaign is nearly 13 years in the past. We have a caucus just weeks away. What are your thoughts about the present political environment, maybe the candidates? I don't know. What do you want to comment on about our present day and how it's different from what you experienced then?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, now I live in Washington, D.C., and so I'm a voter in the Washington, D.C. primary, which will come at the tail end of the nominating process. So I think one of the things that's easy for people to take for granted when they live in Iowa is how powerful a voice you can have in this process because of the caucuses. And I think something that was striking to me going back doing this book that I think about sometimes today is how often people would ask the question of Barack Obama, "I don't think he can win," or "I don't know if he can win. I don't know if he's electable." And in hearing Iowans talk about what they're looking for in the caucuses, I know this question of electability comes up a lot. And what I hope that Iowans will do when they go to caucus is support the person they want to be president, not just the person they think can win. Because when I looked back at 2008, one of the things that's noticeable is when you look at the exit polls in 2008 from the caucus, the people that cared most about electability supported John Edwards by an overwhelming margin. Mm. Obama was third to them. And as we remember from 2008, John Edwards ended up fathering a child with someone who worked for him, a story that broke right around the time of the Democratic National Convention and probably would have sunk his general election campaign. And I think you look back at all these different election cycles that we go through here in Iowa. In 2004, I caucused for John Kerry, and I remember thinking, how could George Bush possibly beat a war veteran, a hero like John Kerry in the general election?
And then we had the Swift voting.
And then we had the Swift voting. In 2016, how many times did I personally and many others say to people, there's absolutely no way Donald Trump can win a general election? How could that happen? And even in 2018, I remember talking to somebody right after Trump's election and them saying, I'm going to devote all my energy to taking back the House of Representatives in 2018. And me thinking at the time, well, there's absolutely no way that can happen. I mean, gerrymandering makes that impossible. And what you see again and again is people predicting what they think will be politically possible and not the politics they want to see. And what I hope Iowans do when they go to the caucus is support the person they most want to be president, not just the person they think can win, because there's no way to know who can win. And so you might as well just support the person that you want to be president.
That is a wonderful place to end this conversation. Chris Liddell Westerfeld, author of They Said This Day Would Never Come. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real treat to be here.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.